voltage is high enough that the bird watt meter slug must, in a linear manner, pick up the instantaneous, let me drop it. It's got to pick up the magnitude of the voltage accurately at that point in the line, the magnitude of the current accurately on that point of the line, the direction of the current at that point, and mix the two together to come up with the right amount of forward power and reverse power. It is easy to take a bird watt meter when you're near the upper end of its dynamic range, and I go to a voltage hotspot where now the internal rectifying diode starts acting in a nonlinear manner. I will see an erroneous reading. If I go to that exact same hotspot, go to half the power output of the transmitter, and repeat the experiment, I think in that case I will get the right power. The bird watt meter is a little bit like a watt-hour meter that's outside your house. It really takes into account magnitude of voltage, magnitude of current, phase angle between the two, and really properly indicates the amount of electrical power that you are really consuming. A bird watt meter is like that. As long as you're using it within its linear region, it's got to tell the truth, and at that hot spot, there really isn't a difference in forward power and reverse power. You can get an erroneous reading if you misuse your meter, but properly used, I think it's got to give the right answer. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
November 2X3, you read November. I do agree with what you say, but you've got to understand one thing. When the energy is being turned into the heat, according to the second law of thermodynamics, you're going to have preservation of energy. When the energy becomes heat, there has to be indication on the meter of the factor of losing the energy. Am I right? And to Isaiah.
I think you're right. If I'm not smart enough and I'm using a coaxial cable that at my frequency has significant amount of loss in decibels per 100 feet or decibels per 10 meters, if you know what I mean, if there's a significant amount of loss in my cable, now when I measure apparent standing wave ratio, apparent forward power versus reverse power, and I start the measurement at the antenna, and I come down halfway in the middle of the transmission line, make a measurement, and I come all the way down to the shack and I make a measurement, those measurements will continuously change, because the real power going down that line, if the line's got significant loss, it's getting weaker and weaker because of the line loss before it gets to the antenna. The antenna still, because of its VSWR, reflects a predictable percentage of that power. Then the reflected power starts going back down that line, experiences the line loss again. And therefore, when I'm sitting in the shack, the apparent standing wave ratio in the shack is a significantly lower number than the real antenna because of the line loss. If I make the line loss greater and greater by using a longer and longer transmission line, or if I put attenuating pads, if I put attenuating devices in that line and make the measurement of apparent standing wave ratio on the input end of that system, the apparent standing wave ratio will get better and better and better in measurement. Let me drop for a second. But if I'm smart enough to know that the pads I put in have X number of dB of loss, and if I'm smart enough to know that my particular transmission line has Y dB of loss, and I measure what appears to be the forward to reverse power ratio, and I make that measurement in the shack, and then I take those losses that I know about and crank them back out, and I increase the apparent reflected power by the appropriate amount, if I'm smart enough to do all that, I can sit in the shack and make a pretty yucky measurement, correct that measurement, and come up to an extremely high accuracy prediction as to what was the real standing wave ratio at the antenna if I had the wherewithal to go up there and make the measurement at that point. So these losses of cable, losses of pads and other things I put in there, there's ways of, because they behave in a deterministic manner, if I'm smart enough with the mathematics, I can crank that all back out and find out exactly what's going on. So what's the bottom line of all this? Know that there's ways of misusing your standing wave ratio meter. You can shove it into a nonlinear region under certain conditions. Wesley is bringing that to our attention. I'm going to agree with that. And all of this impedance matching and all of this measurement jazz can be done in the shack if you're smart enough and come up with the right answers. And if you're smart... I just had a power outage. If you're smart enough to come up with the right measurements and understanding in the shack, you can correct all of that. Over to you, Wesley, and in case you want to disagree with some of that. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, comment.
Okay. November to X-ray, Julius November. In reality, you will never have such thing as a steady, not moving field that behaves with the time at the same way. That is, once the heat accumulates, once the energy is being transmitted and reflected, you're gonna see with that time the changing pattern. And when you look at that hot spot, you're gonna see that it hot spot move an inch or 2 inches. At that point, trying to predict or calculate is in reality almost impossible. There is always something that is being called nose. Nose is the nose that you have. It is an experience. Back to you, Anthony.
What I think you're saying, Wesley, is that as the coaxial cable with loss heats up, every reel piece of coaxial cable with loss is temperature sensitive. When those hot spots get hotter, the amount of loss of the cable increases. I found that out the hard way because there was a time when I was running a 700 watt transmitter. I had a power meter that couldn't tolerate 700 watts. I had the great idea of saying, okay, I'm going to use a certain number of feet of RG8 cable, and at the end of that I'm going to put a certain number of feet of RG58 cable. I can easily measure on good laboratory instrumentation what is the insertion loss of all of that cable. It's a nice, long, linear attenuator. It can take lots of watts, and I can calibrate it, and therefore I can make some nice power measurements. You do that, you apply the power to the thing, and you watch the watt meter. You first press down the key, the watt meter comes up to the right number. And you sit there and watch it, and you watch the watt meter slowly fade downward a little bit. What's going on is your pieces of cable are heating up, and the insertion loss increases, and you didn't calibrate it for that particular mode. However, if you're smart enough, even that is predictable. But you got to be careful. Your transmission line has a particular insertion loss at some particular temperature. You will see a difference between a cold winter day and a hot summer day with the sun shining on the cable. The insertion loss is a different number, and the VisWire you measure in the shack will be a different number. And if you're not smart enough to catch that, you'll think the VisWire of your antenna gets better in the summertime. Not necessarily. Let's see what Paul has to say about all this. WS2F, K2LIW, make sure you wait for the beep, Paul.
I hear it. Very good, Dick. About 5 minutes ago, you mentioned 160 watts going up toward the antenna. Well, 160 watts isn't being radiated. So I realize that, but I don't know. I'm just sitting here doing the math, when I started doing it, it looked like, well, that can't be. But as I went further, I kept adding and dividing. No matter what I do, I can't even get above 100 watts. Here's the example I use. Instead of 60, I use 50. I use 100 watts going up, going through the antenna tuner, and the antenna, going up to from the antenna tuner to the antenna. 100 watts going up, and then I had 50 watts coming back. That means 50 watts is going out the antenna. And then I did it again. Now I have another 100 watts coming up from the transmitter, passing the antenna tuner, and that's being added to the 50 watts. And I have 150 watts going up to the antenna. And again, I divide by 2, and I got 75. Let me drop it.
K2YO. Bernie recognized. Let me interrupt you, Paul. I know where you're going. Stand by for a second.
I can't get over 100, Dick. It's great.
I understand. When I said 160, I did a rough lag approximation. And by the way, you are adding and subtracting watts in the analysis you just did. Good, logical thing to do. Mother Nature doesn't think that way. Mother Nature, human beings love to think in watts. Mother Nature thinks only in voltages. She takes the voltage of the reflection coefficient of that antenna, reflects it back down the line. That voltage hits your antenna tuner, your matchbox, and that voltage gets re-reflected with the voltage coming out of the transmitter at this time. Those two voltages get added together. So I'm a little bit wrong on the 160 watts. That was just a pure guess. Is the real number 157 or 175? I don't know. But for the second week in a row, I'm going to promise to actually do that calculation for you. And what you're doing, as you can tell, is a so-called infinite series mathematics. You can either do it by setting it up as a computer program, and you tell the computer program, go through that loop as a do loop and do it 4,000 times, and that's an answer that's close enough. That's one way of doing it. Or you can hop ahead. Let me drop. And there's a whole branch of mathematics about infinite series simplification. There's a way you can readjust the program, readjust the equation so that it predicts for you what it's going to be like after an infinite number of bounces. So first of all, to do it accurately, Paul, you've got to calculate voltages, not powers, and then it's an infinite series. You are on the right step when it comes to the infinite series, but you did it in watts. You won't come up with the right number. And is the real number for a 5.828 standing wave ratio, is the real number 160 watts of apparent power on that third watt meter beyond the antenna tuner? I've got to find that number out for you. But you're on the right track. You see the principle. We've got a little bit of the mathematics wrong, but you see the principle. And so you got it right in that respect. Bernie, Mr. Wyo, nice meeting you today. K2LIW. Go ahead, Bernie. Wait for the beep.
AZ2UJL.
Good evening, Dick and the net. I hate to be the net nanny, but two things, Dick. Number one, it's 10:17 p.m. Number two, you and Wesley have timed out the eastern end four times now. You guys just got to start waiting on that beep.
It wasn't me.
Okay, Wesley was innocent, so obviously it's me. And you're absolutely right, Bernie. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. KG2, Victor Juliet Lima, go right ahead. I am going to let Paul tell us about space, and then we're going to go over to the... I didn't keep to the schedule. Oh, well, we tried. KG2, VJL, start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. K2RIW, TechNet, my name is Dick.
This is KC2UJL, Brooklyn, New York. My name is Tony, Tango, Oscar, November, Yankee.
Okay, Tony, do you have a question or a comment? If it's a question, we're going to have to delay it a little bit if it's on a different subject. If it's a comment on what's occurred up till now, proceed, Tony. You've got it, Tony.
Okay, I've been listening out here, all of the figures and facts and all of this stuff. Well, I've been involved with radio since 1963, a little over 35 years. And the velocity factor has a lot to do with the amount of power from the transmitter to the antenna. And I find that with low wattage and 100% modulation, I'll go up against anything out there as far as RF goes. Modulation will travel further than wattage. So you can take a transmitter, it gives me 5 watts with 100% modulation and a good microphone, and a 1.1-to-1 SWR. With a good antenna, and I'll work any country in the world. I even work Vietnam. So I'm just trying to figure out what all this wattage in that. I don't really believe in antenna tuners, honestly. I think they're just big capacitors, and if a person can achieve a 1.1 or a 1.5, well, then I tell you. Antenna tuners to me are just cheating the radio, fooling the final of the radio and cheating the antenna. In actuality, when it comes down to facts and figures, it didn't do anything. The antenna tuner just did one thing. It capacitated the amount of signal from the back of the transceiver to the top of the antenna. KC2UJL, Brooklyn, New York.
Tony, you have just expressed an opinion that probably 90% of the ham radio fraternity assumes is the gospel truth. 90% of the ham radio operators believe that. They believe that a matchbox slash antenna tuner is a cheater and that it's eating up the reverse power, the reflected power, and throwing it away. A hell of a lot of them believe that. And they believe, now, you have the freedom to decide whether or not you want to use an antenna tuner, a matchbox. And you believe that it's cheating and it's not really doing what you think it's doing. Okay? That there are a number of smart people on this net right now who have another opinion. And they've made laboratory measurements that lead them to believe that all is well. The fact that you hear it from 90% of the guys you talk to on 20 meters, as I usually say, doesn't mean it's accurate. When you apply RF energy to a radiating system, let me drop. There's only two things within the laws of conserve energy that can happen to that valuable RF energy, the 5 watts of your example. There's only two things that can happen to it. You're either going to radiate it from the antenna, or you... Boy, I just had another power outage here. Boy, there's a lot of nasty things going on in my town right now. My computer has just failed. my UPS failed a couple of days ago.
Yes, don't worry.
My wife complained about why the power is dropping out in our neighborhood. I'm a little bit worried about somebody having struck a telephone pole somewhere down the line. All right, we're back on the line right now. The antenna tuner does not waste power. There's only two things. Let me drop one more time. There's only two things that your antenna radiating system, antenna feed line, matchbox, final tank circuit, whatever, everything beyond that transmitting tube or transmitting transistor. There's only two things that can happen to that RF energy. It either gets radiated by the antenna or wasted as heat somewhere. There's nothing else you can do with that power. And if you're smart enough to measure the temperature of your coax cable and find out it's running ice cold and it's not wasting power, measure the temperature of your well-shielded match box and it's not running hot if it's ice cold, and if you apply 5 watts to that matchbox, believe it or not, the equivalent of 5 watts is coming out of it and being radiated by that antenna if your feed line is low enough in loss. The real loss of your feed line, when you've got significant standing wave ratio that has to be corrected by your matchbox, because that power is bouncing back and forth, as Paul has discovered with his infinite series calculations that he started doing, beautiful calculation, gives you a good feeling as to what's going on. Because the power is bouncing back and forth multiple times on that lossy piece of transmission line. The total loss it creates, let me drop. The total loss it creates increases. You go to the appropriate curve in the antenna engineering handbook, ARRL antenna book, or your radio amateur's handbook. You go to the bright curve on the transmission line section. It'll tell you what is the extra loss of your cable because of the known standing wave ratio of your antenna. But neglecting that extra loss of the cable, which can be quantified, you can predict it ahead of time, you can measure it by the temperature with your hands or with a thermometer or with a thermocouple or whatever. And again, you can measure the temperature of your matchbox. What I'm saying is that a well-designed, well-shielded matchbox cannot waste power. If your feed line is low enough in loss and you start off with 5 watts, you will radiate 5 watts no matter what the standing wave ratio of the antenna is, if the feed line is low enough in loss. I know that that doesn't sound like common sense. I don't blame you for saying, if Tony says, hey Dick, I disagree with you. I don't blame you. Keep an open mind on this one. As you get deeper and deeper into what's going on, hopefully you're going to be one of the guys correcting all of those majority opinions. This is one of the cases when the majority is not right. Most of the time, the majority is right. They're not right on this one, Tony. I don't blame you for being skeptical. Try to hold an open mind. Don't come to a complete conclusion yet. KC2, UJL in Brooklyn, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Wait for the beep.
Okay, Dick, I listened to what you had to say. I worked in Tucson, Arizona, with a SWR around 6-7. This is back place 3 years ago. I worked Vietnam on 3 watts with D104 and a 101% modulation. And what did I tell you? SWRs were flat. No movement whatsoever from my reflection on my SWR meter, with no antenna tuner in line whatsoever. So, I mean, I've been fooling around with radios for quite a while. So, I mean, if people want to use antenna tuners, that's up to them. I mean, personally, I believe you should be able to achieve the standing wave ratio between a transceiver and an antenna without using the antenna tuner. If you can't, you know, the 1.5 is between a 1 and a 1.5, there isn't much difference. I mean, honestly, you know, anything over that, well, then you got some loss. And it's according to the type of coax that you're using. But, if you're using the linear, which I don't believe in linear, what could I say? But that just got my way, and I'm listening to what you got to say, and whatever. I just want to get my opinion in there. From Canarsie, right off of Jamaica Bay, KG2UJL, Brooklyn, New York.
Comment.
Very fine, Tony. Tony is a QRP operator from way back. He has the philosophy of the guy that goes fishing with 4-pound line and he wants to land a 15-pound fish. He likes that particular challenge. I know where he's coming from, and he enjoys QRP, and he makes it work very well. So there's all kinds of philosophies going on here, and they all work. Go ahead with your comment, Wesley. N2XJN, KQLAW, the TechNet, wait for the beep.
November to X-ray, Juliet, November. I do agree with Dick. And one thing that I want to add. If I had to choose, and I repeat that because I already said that once, between antenna tuner or amplifier, the good old-fashioned amplifier, each one has the antenna tuner that is able to match 6 to 1, at least 6 to 1. And my understanding is that if you really want to have a QSO and you have a family and this family actually doesn't want you to spend the rest of your life in front of the radio, use amplifier. Don't waste money on antenna tuner. You're going to have both. And the second of all, if somebody like to be QRP, which I admire these guys, these guys are very unique. Let him do it. But not everybody has the freedom and time to do that. Back to you, Dick, and to Israel.
He has lots of philosophies on the best way to get the most fun out of your particular ham radio. That's the nice thing about this hobby. You got a zillion different frequencies to choose from. There is no other service in the world that is given anywhere near the amount of spectrum we're given. You pass that ham radio license, and the FCC gives you a significant chunk of bandwidth, every single octave up the band, almost from DC to light. That there are commercial companies out there that would give their IT to get that kind of spectrum. It's handed to you free of charge. That's one hell of a gift. And you choose the frequency, you choose the power, you choose the mode of modulation, you choose the polarity, you choose the kind of antenna, and go for it. Whatever pleases you. And as I said often, there's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of them. And if it doesn't thoroughly please you, before you give up the hobby, try one of the other 25 times kinds. QRP is one of the very significant ones. Let me drop. So there's lots of ways of doing it. And if you decide that you want to be a purist, and that you're smart enough to make a good impedance match at the antenna itself, that's the purest way of doing it, the right way of doing it. So you never need an antenna tuner. You have the freedom of doing that, and you can be proud of the results when you do it. But even if you're forced to use an antenna tuner, and even if your antenna is really yucky by most modern-day standards, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is usually the threshold of grief where the average guy will say, boy, if you got any pride, you wouldn't use a 2-to-1 antenna or worse. You would tune it for better. As bad as a 2-to-1 antenna is, and if your tuning and loading controls on your transmitter, back in the days when you had real tuning transmitters, not these no-tune things. Back in the days when, as Wesley is saying, you could tolerate a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio, and as long as those tuning and loading controls don't run out of range, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst case, is only half a dB of loss of total transmitted power. That's 1/12 of an S unit on your S meter, of a well-calibrated S meter on the receiver. To me, that's insignificant. 2-to-1, as bad as it sounds, represents only half a dB of loss if you didn't properly impedance match it, as long as your transmitter can tolerate it. Okay, let's see what's going on in space. I know we're supposed to go over to the mailbag. We're going to go to space first because Paul's got to, he's got to go to work tomorrow, and I don't want to keep him up too late. WS2N, what are those astronauts doing, Paul? What are those beautiful spacecraft out there doing, and what have they discovered? WS2N, our space expert, wait for the beep, and look at your watch, K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, no work. Now I'm retired. Dick, the, by the way, I'm glad you stopped me. I would have stopped. I got the 14 calculations, and I got 99.95 and 117. I mean, it was going on and on. Getting closer to that 100 mark, but there was no way that was going over 100 watts out. Okay, we got to use volts next time. But whatever, the numbers with that infinite series calculation, I was amazed. I'm saying, look at this. It started off as fake, but after 14 trips back and forth, it's very hard to get even close to 100. You know, close, but not over. Space report. Well, Dick, the International Space Station is over 98% complete, so we're not going to have much to talk about. They plan on keeping it up for at least, it was originally 10 years, now I'm hearing at least 15 years, and my guess will probably go on way beyond 15 years. So we could always talk about what maybe the science that they're doing on board the space station. Let me drop it. With that last mission, putting the cupola up with the seven windows, the six trapezoidal looking windows, and the one round one above, directly above them. If you see it on the internet, it's pretty neat. They're looking down at Earth. You could put two people up in that viewing area at the same time, and they have, you know, you're basically looking at a window that's, you know, 5 feet in diameter. So it's pretty good. They'll be able to see all the cargo ships coming up, and the European Space Agency, all their supply ships, and the manned missions from Russia. But they won't see any more shuttles there. Four more flights, that's all we got going up. And they're just basically supply flights, bringing up nitrogen tanks and big heavy materials and extra robot arm, I think, or something. Things that they might need in the future. But the station itself is really complete. The only launch coming up is on the 3rd, this week of March. Let me drop it. By the National Oceanic Administration, Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, they're putting up a GOES satellite. They call it GOES-P. The GOES are the weather satellites, the geostationary operational environmental satellites that they've been putting up for decades now. And they're up to the letter P. You know, so I said P as a Papa, because they started off with A back in 1975, and these are in the 23,000 miles up, looking down at one location on Earth, and that's what we always see our weather satellites on the news. You know, that's what this is all coming from. You look at your nightly news, and those pictures are coming from these satellites. Since in the 1970s, the first generation group, they used to spin. So every time they spun around, then they would take a picture. So It was on the slow side. Let me drive it. This WS2N. And then they went to a second generation some years later. The letters between the letters I and M. And they were no spin, three axis stabilized type of satellites where they stayed in space, the solar panels moved, tracked the sun, but the satellites stayed in place, so they were able to get the idea is to get a shorter time frame pictures between, you know, every time they take a picture of the of whatever they're looking at, hurricanes or whatever, and the shorter time frame between the two, the better idea of what, where these things are going, and, you know, maybe it might hit an island, or it might not, you know, in relation to a hurricane. If they're off by a couple of miles, it wouldn't be that way if they cut the time down in between. Like, future satellites are going to be, you know, instead of, like, every 20 minutes that they have now, it'll be down to every 5 minutes. So it'll be more accurate there. Detection. I mean, they've used these things for even search and rescue. You know, if you send a signal up, the satellites will pick it up, and all the newer ones have that. So, this, you know, this one is, of course, more advanced. They'll have better pictures and better telemetry coming back regarding the temperatures of the water and the atmosphere, and they go up on a pretty big rocket, a Delta IV rocket, but it's one of the bigger ones. So, since 1975, we've had them, Dick. We don't talk about much weather as far as the space program on the space portion of the net, so I thought I'd bring that up with the GO satellite, March 3rd. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Came very close on that last transmission pull. You went a little over 2 minutes, but I don't think you timed out the machine. I'm still disappointed that only four more shuttle launches are going to take place. That's an awful nice space bus, and we don't have the replacement vehicle for some ridiculous number of years yet. And one of the things that we all forget about is that the International Space Station is a group effort of a whole lot of countries, huge investment in hardware, but it's out there, I forget the exact distance, is it 230 nautical miles or something like that? It is continuously experiencing Earth atmosphere drag. Let me drop. As such, on each shuttle mission, when you link up with the International Space Station, when you have a certain amount of thrusting hardware, you know, your rocket engines, you have a certain amount of fuel left over, they, on almost every one of those missions, do a boost to the space station. When you're flying the shuttle at its normal orbit, they do a burn every 24 hours to keep it at the right altitude. Although the International Space Station is a higher altitude and therefore it experiences less drag, it's still experiencing an amount of drag and it needs a periodic boost to keep it on the right altitude. And the shuttle has got a whole lot of boost capability that can do that. Once we stop flying the shuttles, so once we go over to, I think it's the Soyuz, but the Soviet equivalent, I don't think it's got anywhere near as much boosting capability left over. Therefore, the amount of extra boost that's going to be given to the International Space Station on each landing, so to speak, of a spacecraft going up there is going to be less. To your knowledge, Paul, have they discussed whether or not there's any fear of not being able to maintain the International Space Station at the right altitude because of not as much boosting power left over with the alternate vehicle that's going to be going up there? WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, every time the shuttle goes up, they boost it up 14 miles. That's about the average that they push it up. With the Progress ships, they're the supply ships by the Russians. They have a certain amount of boost capability. Then they deorbit, burn up in the atmosphere. Naturally, you can't do that with the Soyuz. The Soyuz spacecraft, they don't really use that as a boosting mechanism. They get in there and fly back. So, it's just the progress ships and eventually the ATVs, the automatic transfer vehicles from the being built in Italy for the European Space Agency. They're a lot bigger. They're about three or four times bigger than the progress ships. And they do have extra fuel on board, and they'll be docked with the space station for about 6 months and then loaded up with garbage. They too will deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere, but they will have a lot more fuel on board. And we you know, they've let me drop it. The cancellation of the Constellation program is going to knock out the boost capability that we would have had with the Orion spacecraft. So, since that's all presently gone, no lunar missions, no Orion spacecraft, not good. My guess is they'll probably just keep sending up more and more progress ships and ATVs. Don't forget you have a crew of six up there to be supplied. There's going to be a lot more missions, unmanned missions, than there have been in the past to supply these extra three people that are on board. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so maybe I'm worrying unnecessarily about losing enough boost, losing the right amount of boost capability when we abandon the shuttle. It's too bad that we got to abandon that. A beautiful vehicle that's only got that one little problem of pieces of foam breaking off, hitting the wing, and potentially damaging them, like occurred with the Columbia disaster, that particular mission. I still think there's ways of stopping that foam from doing that, but I know they've tried very hard and haven't succeeded up till now. Okay, during the flea market that occurred today, the convention that was held at the Levittown Hall, a number of people, Bernie Y.O. among others, brought to my attention the fact that I'm probably being a little bit too harsh when I say that the mailbag is not something we promised. They made it clear to me that there's a significant number of people out there who listen to the TechNet who don't yet have their ham radio license. They want to know some of the specifics of how all this hardware works. They can't get on the air and ask a live question like all the people present here have done. Their only mechanism of getting the information they're looking for is Mel's mailbag. So they're trying to influence me to give a little more emphasis to mailbag. So therefore, we're trying to go back to the mailbag earlier. And tonight at 10:45 is the earliest we've ever done that, Mel. So hopefully you've got some of those questions, the burning questions these guys would like to know, and go right ahead and give us the first question. Sign in, please, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2RY.
Stand by a minute, Mel. Joe, you agree or disagree with that, Joe? Go right ahead.
No, I have no comment. I have a neutral comment on that. My comment is, I'm noticing that between the internet output and your 2-meter machine in Glen Oaks, you hear a courtesy tone on Glen Oaks, which is about 1.5 to 2 seconds long between transmissions. You do not get the same pause in time on the internet. You hear you drop it, and it sounds like somebody else is picking it up right away, and you've timed out the reflector 4 or 5 times already. I have to keep on resetting my nose. So can somebody look into this technical problem? You got some sort of issue with the IRLP node, the way it's hooked up to the repeater up there in Glen Oaks. It's not the same as what you hear on the output of the with the courtesy tone. There's like no delay on the well, there's a lot of delay on the COS line apparently or something like that, because you don't hear a drop. You hear a drop and when the courtesy tone is on 2 meters, but not the same on the on the internet. So that's probably why you keep on timing out the reflector.
That is incorrect. November to X-ray Juliet November. I can hear Dick on the input. And what I see is I've heard a few times that somebody's putting courier and to X-Gen.
No, that's got nothing to do with it.
Joe, give me an estimation from what you now know. If we wait for the beep, and you're telling us that we have to wait some amount of period beyond the beep before we pick up, to make sure we don't time out the node. What's your best estimate, Joe, as to how many seconds we should wait beyond the beep to make sure we don't time out the load, time out the node I'm back to you, Joe.
Okay, I just heard the courtesy tone. I just picked it up immediately after the courtesy tone. What I'm hearing on the internet is about a half a second delay. If you drop it and I pick it up when I hear the courtesy tone, you combine it together, there's about a half a second delay. Even though on 2 meters it sounds like it's about a 1 or 2 second delay. So there's a significant difference between the two.
Okay, let me try this one then. If I wait for the beep, and then wait 1.5 or 2 seconds beyond the beep before I pick up, for the time being, before the situation is corrected, do you believe that will be sufficient? Over to you, Joe.
I don't know how you got the thing wired up there. Why don't you ask K2HL? He's got it wired. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to work or not.
Okay, then the best we can do is wait for the beep and wait a couple of seconds beyond the beep before we pick up. The discipline required for this crew to do that when they get hot and heavy on a subject, wow. If we don't have a gun to our heads, we're not going to do that, but we'll try. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. I know that Eric and Andy are working on this one, and it's not an easy one. But I know that they've got a couple of solutions coming down the pipe. Hopefully this is going to get better. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead with our mailbag, and I know that we should be giving it a little bit more emphasis. Multiple people brought that to my attention today when they had a discussion with me. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that's why I didn't go. Too many people after me, Dick. I did get some flack today on the 10-meter net morning that I run, and they asked technical question. They finally said, oh, we get an answer from you here on 10 meters. Yeah, Roger. Well, as far as the tunas, oh, I can say, never get to it, but that's been one of the questions that I've asked and asked many a times about tuna matchbox situation, and the misunderstanding is tremendous. Nobody, they don't really, I can't fight it no more. So whatever anyone wants to come up with any kind of a, their thinking of what a tuna or a matchbox does is, most cases, I should say, the vast majority is wrong, Dick. So that's where a good part of it goes. Let me let it drop. Okay. That's where it seems to be going, continuous. I don't know if we'll ever get it straightened out. Okay, I'm just thumbing through here. Here's one that's been also coming around. There's been an antenna that is being sold now. Basically, it's about a 25-foot pipe. It's actually a monopole. The pipe with a like standoff. And what they're claiming is actually made in, where the heck is it made? Made in Germany. Somebody sent me an advertisement on it. 25 feet tall, and it covers 80 through 6 meters. And it claims better across that whole entire stand. So let me let it drop. Claims across that whole span from 6 meters to 80 meters. That it does better than 2-to-1 SWR. It is actually, you look at it, a folded monopole, Dick. So, it's matched very uniquely with a length of cable and a 50-ohm resistor on the end of a length of cable. So they would like to know, is this kind of antenna a viable antenna, a vertical, called a folded monopole, Dick, over.
Well, it's got a length of cable. I presume you mean a coaxial stub. By the way, let me just let it drop the right length of time. I presume you mean that's a coaxial reactive stub-like thing, a key connector somewhere in the transmission line over to the 50-ohm load, which is part of the antenna assembly. Reminds me a little bit of that very broadband dipole-like structure that was popular, well, I wouldn't say popular, but being advertised and sold, oh, about 15 years ago. And it had a great big molded assembly in the middle of this dipole. The dipole gave extremely good standing wave ratio across multiple bands. And when people finally whittled away at that very tough epoxy-like substance in that black box in the, was the middle of the dipole, they found out there was a load resistor in there. And my goodness, did that create a furor. Holy mackerel. The guys at ARRL headquarters, and I guess it was Lou McCoy in particular, boy, they rode herd on that company and made them to believe that they're the worst charlatans in the world, and they really did a bad thing, and it's illegal, and it's immoral, and fattening, and everything bad. Oh, boy, people really got mad at that company that put that dummy load resistor, partial dummy load resistor, in the middle of that dipole. Lots and lots of opinions on that, and when the majority of the opinions were that was a bad company. And I think that product is no longer being manufactured, and they got run out of town, tarred and feathered, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. From my point of view, that was a pretty strong misunderstanding of the laws of physics. If an ordinary dipole on 80 meters gives you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio bandwidth, which only covers, let's say, 2/3 of the band, and you want to cover the low end and the high end of the band, and if you're smart enough to put an impedance matching network in there that includes a load resistor, and if that load resistor only comes into play when you're down at the low end of the band and up at the high end of the band, and if because of that load resistor, 30% of your RF energy is being turned into heat, and the rest of it is radiated by the antenna, 30% of your power being lost in that manner is something like a 2 decibel loss. Maybe it's 1.5. We can calculate that. But it's something reasonable. If it was a 2 decibel loss, that's a loss of 1/3 of an S unit of a well-calibrated receiver. Except during a pileup, when you're trying to climb above the rest of the crowd shouting for that rare DX station. No one is going to know the difference. Let me drop. And if the presence of that resistor allows you to take your no-tune transmitter, and now you can use it at the low end of the band and the high end of the band without a matchbox, and you ordinarily wouldn't be able to do it. From my point of view, that's a beautiful compromise, a beautiful mixture. But an awful lot of people have the philosophy that anything more than 1.5% of my valuable RF energy is being wasted by the antenna. They want to take that antenna engineer and shoot him. That's crazy. If my antenna had 50% efficiency, because the rest of it is being burned up with heat, because I've got an internal resistor in the antenna matching assembly, 50% of the power wasted, I'll admit that you better have some pretty good heat sinking on that thing, because if I'm running a kilowatt and 500 watts is being dissipated, as I said, there better be some pretty good fins on there to dissipate 500 watts without turning, without glowing red in the dark, if you know what I mean, and melting down. But if the guy satisfies that requirement, that he can handle the power, and he's doing a resistive impedance match at one end of the band and the other end of the band, that's not a bad compromise. That's a valuable antenna, a valuable, slightly valuable antenna. 3 dB of loss is all you get with 50% efficiency. That's half an S unit down. That's not a showstopper. It solves a problem. It takes your antenna no-tune, it takes your no-tune rig and allows you to use that without worrying about VISWR. You spin the dial, you QSY, you don't have to worry about retuning things, you're on the day, on the air, you press down the key and you talk to the guy. That's a good solution to chastise the company that does that. As long as they tell you ahead of time, let me drop. As long as they tell you ahead of time what the antenna is doing, if they're upfront about it, and if you're willing to make that compromise, that's a darn good antenna. That's a design philosophy that works. And because it violates your particular understanding of antenna efficiency, and you don't want to buy it, that's your choice. You vote with your pocketbook. So antennas that contain a dummy load as part of the impedance matching network in order to get instantaneous bandwidth with a no-tune transmitter, that's not a bad solution. So knowing that much philosophy ahead of time, knowing that there's a resistor in there, and they're letting you know it's there, knowing there's a dummy load somewhere in the antenna, that's not necessarily bad. And when you study that antenna and that step tuner, if I understand correctly, I think you're going to discover that the amount of power that goes into that 50-ohm dummy load changes as a function of which band and which end of the band, what frequency you're on. And if it corrects that Dizwar and makes it 2-to-1 everywhere, and if your particular transmitter can tolerate 2-to-1 without tripping out, it is a solution. It's not a bad solution. It's not perfect. But if you look at the degree of difficulty of trying to make an antenna, let me drop. Trying to make an antenna a 1.3-to-1 standing wave ratio across every one of those bands, and the full bandwidth of every one of those bands, the degree of difficulty there where you're in, so to speak, violating the Bode-Fano criteria. If you take a look at, Posar. Posar wrote an extremely good book on RF techniques. I can't think of the name of the book, but Posar, P-O-S-A-R, I think is the spelling of his name. And you look at the Bode-Fano equation, where it predicts with normal inductor, capacitor, impedance matching networks, when you start off with a known characteristic impedance across the frequency range of your particular antenna, the Bode-Fano criteria tells you with normal passive LC networks what's the best possible standing wave ratio you're going to get across that bandwidth with that antenna. That's a pretty solid laws of physics established quite a long time ago. That's the good news. There's even better news. If you're smart enough to use modern metamaterials, and someday I'll go into what that means, because I've got a patent on a metamaterial antenna that's being processed by the patent office right now. And that particular antenna is so high in performance that it has gone into an item that's going into production even before the patent has been issued. But once you're smart enough to use metamaterials, which means it has the equivalent of a dielectric constant, that changes as a function of frequency. When you're smart enough to use those techniques, you can go far beyond the Bode-Fano equation. This antenna that you're describing is not using that yet, but someday we're going to be able to buy antennas that do that. Let me drop. So when it comes to antennas, and you think, it's like saying, as some president did way back in 1930, gee, they've done everything they can with an automobile, it's not going to get any better than this. And some other foolish person way back in 1910 says, well, we've already invented everything. There's nothing new to invent. Let's close down the patent office. Oh, really? And so just because there's 5,000 antennas out there, and you think that we've done everything in antennas, there's nothing new under the sun, as they say, or as the Russians will say, nothing new under the moon? Uh-uh. You ain't seen nothing yet. There's going to be brand new materials invented. So I'm not against that. And although it takes an acceptance of a particular philosophy of life, of use of ham radio antennas, I think potentially the Germans are doing something that's reasonably intelligent, is my first impression. Now, why don't you tell me the exact brand name of this antenna, and we get a chance to look it up, we can dig a little bit deeper. But I'm not turned off by that at all, even though there are a significant number of people out there, including Lou McCoy, a good, honest, hard-working ham radio operator, with a lot of good opinions. As smart as Lou McCoy was, like every other human being, he did not bat 1,000. Once in a blue moon, he made a minor error. Every one of us does, no matter how hard we try. Lou might have been a little bit wrong on this one. It's an opinion. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY. Make sure you wait for the beep. And a little bit more, K2LAW in the TechNet.
N2EL with some information.
Okay, wait for the beep and go ahead, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I got in here a little late, quite a bit late tonight. It's not the resistor itself that the ARRL objected to. I remember the article in QST exposing this company. What they were doing was selling it for an inordinate amount of money, like $400 and $500. They were calling it a solid-state automatic antenna, and what they were doing was they were putting in that box surplus PC boards with components on it. And that's what the ARRL did. They x-rayed that box, and the expose showed that they were just scrap PC boards inside that did nothing. And they were selling it for inordinate amount of money. It's not the resistor, it's the way it was being marketed. Back to next.
I thank you, Rich, for that correction. So what you're saying is that the advertising didn't have enough degree of honesty, and the price was too high. There was a bit of a rake-off. I'll accept both of those. But still, the concept of the antenna and what it would do under real working conditions, in my mind, is not a bad concept. These guys took unfair advantage of people as far as what they charged and what words they used for advertising and the degree of advertising honesty. And to attack them on those points, I agree. But I know that a significant number of people even bypassed the dollars, because some of these guys have got deep pockets, and they bypassed the wording. They know that Madison Avenue quite often fibs. They bypassed both of those, and they jumped on the fact that there was a lossy network in there, and they started screaming and hollering about the illegality, so to speak, of using a lossy network within an antenna. That's the part that I'm addressing right now, and I think that they were too severe in that opinion. I can also take any one of the antennas that we all use, which has an extremely high standing wave ratio, and if I put a 3 dB attenuator in the feed line, right at the beginning of the feed line in the shack, and that 3 dB attenuator gives me half the power being delivered to the antenna, that's a fall down, but not perfect. Let me drop. And then of the reflected power from the antenna, it comes back through that 3 dB attenuator again, gets another 3 dB of attenuation. My now reflected power ratio just got 6 dB better, just got 4 to 1 better in reflected power ratio by doing nothing but putting in an attenuator, a 3 dB attenuator. For a no-tune transmitter where I want to have the maximum flexibility, where I don't have to fiddle the controls on a matchbox, don't have to do lookup controls, don't have to worry about the antenna tuner arriving at the right answer fast enough, and by a second. As a heated battle approach to doing very fast contest operation, and not worrying about tuning every time I QSY and change bands and change frequencies within the band, as severe as that sounds, putting in a 3 dB attenuator, it is a possible solution. And there are smart guys who are good operating, have good operating practice, who can win a contest doing that. And for a certain kind of guy that's smart enough, that may be a solution. So the fact that there are attenuating devices with your antenna, every antenna that's not perfectly manufactured has some loss somewhere. And now it's just a matter of degree. Can you tolerate 1 dB of loss? Can you tolerate 3 dB of loss? Can you tolerate the 95% efficiency? Can you tolerate 75% efficiency? You pays your money, you takes your choice, you study the problem, and decide, is it good enough for you? Don't reject lossy techniques for impedance matching is my main point. It isn't always bad. It's not illegal to do that. It's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to burn up your transmitter, and you're not going to get slapped with an OO report because you're doing that. Lots of opinions on that one, as you can tell. Over to you, Mel. Great question. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
This is K2KEY. Let's get back to the monopole. Do you believe that a monopole, again, let's make this, you know, stop getting away from what the discussion was. Do you believe a folded monopole that's 25 feet long height and vertically, and it will cover 80 through 6 meters continuous, do you believe that antenna will work that way? And do you believe that it will work with very few, or do you need a sufficient amount of radios? I always thought a monopole antenna would behave most likely similar to a quarter wave antenna, a quarter wave monopole that needs a number of radios. Do you agree or disagree? Over.
Before I proceed, refresh my memory, Mel. You're much better on this one than I am. I keep forgetting about the name of the guy who recently became a silent key, lives in New Jersey, and he wrote quite a series of articles about electrically small ground plane antennas on the HF frequencies. He also wrote a whole lot of articles about balance. Tell me his call letters and name one more time.
This is Jerry Civic. Jerry is a great guy. W2FMI, spoke to him many a time, and we had a number of discussions, But if you'll notice, in all his foreshortened verticals, he had an extensive, look at it, he had an extensive ground plane system.